Good afternoon. I'm Rhonda Fineman, and this is the Healthy Options program right here on WERU Community Radio. Our guest today is Flick Shooter, the Executive Director of Hospice Volunteers of Waldo County. Flick Shooter started as a volunteer in 2003 and has been with the organization since that time. Hospice Volunteers of Waldo County is a community-based, and it's with neighbors helping neighbors. They work closely with volunteers, families, and healthcare partners in their mission to help ensure that no one in Waldo County is alone when facing serious illness, end-of-life decisions, or bereavement. Their services include educational resources on grief, death, and dying, support for caregivers working with those at the end of life, workshops on end-of-life issues and advanced care planning, and also grief support services to anyone who has experienced the loss of a loved one, whether or not that person has received hospice care. So welcome to Healthy Options, Flick Shooter. We appreciate you being here with us to talk about these important services and all of that that Hospice Volunteers of Waldo County discusses and helps our community with.
Thank you, Rhonda. It really is a pleasure to be here. On my favorite radio station, I might add.
There you go. Good. WERU.org. Tell me what you do. What is being an executive director? What is your work?
Well, my work, I probably have one of the best jobs in the world, honestly, because what I get to do is to facilitate the best in our community of taking care of each other. And, you know, taking care of people at the end of life and when they're in grief is, you know, it's very tender work. It brings forth people who are just really caring. Our task is really to sort of create this community of caring for people at the end of life. And that means that I get to work with some really fabulous volunteers. We've trained many, many volunteers over the years. We have a couple of training classes every year. So we're training about, you know, 20 people a year. And we've been around since 1983. So that's a lot of folks in our community. And our volunteers are trained to be hospice volunteers, which is, it's recognized as an organization. And we actually have a DHS license to do the work that we do for the Medicare Hospice Program. And we provide volunteers for hospice Medicare providers and to anybody in our community. And our volunteers go into the home at the family's request at the end of life. And we do anything maybe a good neighbor would do. We don't do anything medical, but we're there to really help families navigate the time. Just because your loved one is dying doesn't mean that you don't have to go get groceries or shovel the snow or maybe pick the grandkids up or mow the lawn. Or it doesn't mean that you don't need, you know, really a loving ear to just listen to what's going on and how hard it is to do one of the hardest jobs in the world. And so, yeah, I get to be with all these wonderful volunteers and to hear from the medical providers who the families are and to assign our volunteers to the families in the best match that we can make. And then to hear from people who are going through the grief and loss process to connect them with our volunteers and to direct them to our support groups or our support services.
Yes. So when one thinks of hospice, often mm-hmm. you just think somebody is dying and we're mm-hmm. here to support that person dying. And what you're talking about is it's even more than that. It's really looking at the whole
Absolutely.
Family system,
yeah.
the whole,
yeah.
the caregiver.
For sure.
Giving, that's such a difficult thing, even to someone sit with the person so the caregiver can take a walk.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, yeah. And I think, you know, there's a huge amount of confusion about hospice itself and hospice volunteers. So we are a completely separate organization. We're our own 501c3. But hospice is, it's a philosophy. It's a way of caring for people. And it's a team approach. And it's also a hospice Medicare benefit. So people who have Medicare insurance or in fact, pretty much all insurance companies have the hospice benefit within their insurance. And it's a team approach. So we are members of that team. The team is led by, overviewed by a hospice physician. And then in that team, there's also a nurse and home health aides. And there's also a social worker who would help with some of the issues that come up at end of life, of which, you know, there's often lots of things because people hadn't been able to make preparations or just, you know, sometimes families are having a hard time with what's going on. And then also, you know, it's one of the only disciplines that really recognizes there's a spiritual context to this, you know, a spiritual aspect to the work. So there's a chaplain. And the volunteers are part of this team, and we partner with the medical agencies. All the hospice pretty much in our area happens in the home. Hospice care happens in the home. Some nursing homes do allow hospice patients to be there, but mostly the hospice care happens in the home. You know, one of the things that also people are confused about hospice is that they think, you know, hospice is something that helps you die. Well, you know, yes, but actually hospice is really about helping people live as fully as they possibly can until they die. And with the extra support that you get with the hospice care, people are able to live much more fulfilling lives. And the caregivers have an easier time. You know, you would, for example, under the Medicare benefit, the hospice Medicare benefit, you get to have a hospital bed, or, you know, which is a whole lot easier for caregivers. And there's commodes and recliner chairs and other pieces of what they call durable medical equipment to help you out. So also a home health aide would be able to come into the home and help you with bathing and those, you know, those kind of personal care things, which can be very, very challenging for people who are trying to take care of their loved one and maybe, you know, aren't in necessarily terribly great shape themselves. And, you know, when somebody is hurt and can't get out of bed, it really takes that kind of help to be able to help people take care of people.
And when you're a caregiver, you know, the relationship shifts. And and something that you wouldn't think you would have to help your spouse or your other family member with. And maybe there's some privacy issues. It's best to have an aide, somebody to help you with these things. And it's so difficult. I mean, one doesn't think of that sometimes on that really practical level. So your volunteers are obviously now doing that part of the
They're
care.
Not doing They're any not personal medical. Care or medical care.
No. Right. But you come into the home running errands or helping. How does that look? You know,
sometimes that looks like, you know, maybe the patient has been bedbound for some time and they're honestly really quite bored because it can get kind of boring being stuck in bed. Maybe what you'll be doing is playing some cribbage. a lot of people like playing cribbage, I've discovered.
Interesting. Okay.
Or maybe, you know, we have a lovely... one of our lovely volunteers, one of the things that she did with her patient was they really wanted to go through their family recipes. You know how like we all have those boxes with like, you know, bits of tattered paper and index cards and cut out whatever. She went through those and the patient picked them out, which ones, and she put, and they ended up putting together the most beautiful family recipe book, which was then the volunteer actually helped produce and created this. Really, I wish I had an example, you know, a picture for you, but this is radio, so I can't tell you, but it was just really beautifully produced. And the patient was able to give it to her family members for, you know, it was just such a precious keepsake the volunteer did it for her. And sometimes, you know, it's looking through photograph albums, or sometimes, you know, one of the lovely things is about it's, you know, as I say, it's neighbors helping neighbors, but we get to meet neighbors that we maybe never would meet. I know I have one of our volunteers who talks about meeting with a farmer out in Liberty, and she got to hear all about his cows and milking cows, you know, way back in the day when it was a whole lot different than it is now. You know, we get to hear just some really precious stories of people tell us, you know, as we get to know people, they tell us a little bit about their lives. And sometimes what we're doing is just being there so that the caregiver can go and, you know, people seem to really enjoy mowing the lawn, you know, like getting on that lawnmower and going up and down. And, you know, that's kind of just a good relaxation for them. Or sometimes, you know,
meditation.
Really,
absolutely. Something, it's like mindless. I don't have to think
exactly
about when the next medication is or what that need
sometimes
is.
Sometimes, you know, it can be just taking a nap, you know, just hanging out. We often are reading to somebody. That can be very, very nice. And sometimes you just sit there and watch telly with them. Or, you know, sometimes you're sitting quietly in the other room. Sometimes there's a great big old load of dishes that just have gotten behind with. So maybe you might roll your sleeves up and do that. So, you know, it's just those kind of things. Sometimes it's bringing a meal or, you know, it can be anything that the family said would be helpful for them.
I wonder if there is singing and music and that kind of
definitely
thing.
We have in the past had the most really special hospice group, singing group, and they have done some beautiful singing bedside, worked particularly in a repertoire which is really calming and gentle, and so that's been one of the, you know, the thing is that having trained so many folks through the community over so many years, we have lots of connections and people, you know, musicians who we can say, hey, could you come and play a little fiddle maybe, or how about some singing, or, you know, somebody has some piano, or somebody wants to have their dog walked, or, you know, or needs their mailbox put back on the stand because it got knocked off again, or, you know, or needs the screen door fixed or whatever, you know, those funny little things of life that, you know, it's like, oh, who do you call? Well, you know what? Yeah, life goes on happening in these caregiving situations.
If you have just joined us, you're listening to Healthy Options right here on WERU Community Radio. I'm Rhonda Feynman, and our guest today is Flick Shooter, Executive Director of Hospice Volunteers of Waldo County, an organization which trains volunteers to be compassionate companions during times of serious illness, dying, and grief. So as we're discussing this, there are just so many levels and different aspects and different, you know, there are people who get into a hospice situation and are still walking around and driving.
Absolutely.
That everybody, people are not, everybody is not in bed.
No.
And for some people, as you know, they're not in bed till a week before they die. I've seen that happen as well.
Yeah.
So you're really channeling what's needed at that moment.
Unfortunately, most of the hospice care that happens in this country happens in the last 10 days of life, which to me is really sad, because really, there is so much help and so much support. But, you know, our kind of cultural conversation, we tend to kind of like fend it all off and not want to talk about it. But actually, people are eligible for hospice if they have a condition which is diagnosed as having 6 months or less to live. And of course, that doesn't mean that, you know, if you're not dead after 6 months, you're chucked off. No, as long as there is some kind of decline, which people, you know, so we
of
have
course.
Had people who have on there for a longer, you know, considerably longer time. And we, as a volunteer organization, we don't mind about that 6 month thing. That's a insurance designation. For us, it doesn't matter at all. So we also have had people who don't quite check the boxes on the criteria for hospice. And we call those our palliative patients, people who are clearly facing the end of life. But we, you know, we don't know when, but, you know, this is clearly where they're going. So we have many patients, probably as many hospice patients, who are our palliative patients. And palliative care is a whole another new discipline, which is becoming more popular and is, again, wonderful. And I would encourage anybody who has a challenging, difficult diagnosis to ask for a palliative care consult. Because what a palliative care consult will do for you is it will help you figure out the care road ahead for you. You know, what the road might look like, what kind of care you might need. And, you know, being prepared and making plans is really, really, really helpful going forward.
So when you're talking about palliative care, I know there's a whole medical discipline.
Yes, exactly.
And you're talking about the med checking in so they can help with medication for pain and those other kinds of things and have that kind of conversation that can help you live well while you're having this diagnosis. That's really important.
Sure.
And I see that you also have a lot of educational resources, and I want to talk about that as we progress. But right now, what is needed to think about end-of-life care? As you said, it's only 10 days before for some people in our culture. That doesn't seem, unless you're in a situation or some spiritual practices, is what you think about all the time, you know, in a Buddhist practice or other religions or traditions. So what is that educational piece? How are you helping people who aren't part of that?
One piece that we're doing specifically is advanced care directives. And advanced care directives are something that anybody who's over the age of 18 should have. And an advanced care directive helps your provider know what choices you would like to make in the context of not being able to communicate those choices for yourself. And we kind of think about them as like, well, you know, that's what people who should have. But actually, you know, anybody who's over the age of 18 and making their own decisions should be doing that. Because, you know, any one of us can have an event where we're in a situation. And I know that having spoken to many, many people over the years about after a death, and that one of the things that I hear most often is that I am so glad that mom or whoever it was made the choices about their care and I didn't have to. So an advanced care directive is a document that you go through and you make decisions about what sort of care you might like in the event of something, you know, catastrophic happening. And there is a really, you know, and it helps people begin having the conversation. And most of us like, you know, I'm like, well, I have no idea. I don't know where to start. But, you know, I would just maybe point people to a great website called The Conversation Project. And at that place, you can, and that's theconversationproject.org. You can start thinking about what matters. And it's a great resource. And it's a great thing to do with your family and your loved ones, to start thinking about those important questions so that you can complete that document and communicate those things to your loved ones. I mean, many people do fill in the advance directives, but sometimes it doesn't make it out of the sock drawer, which is not necessarily the best place for it. It really needs to be filed in your medical record. But most of all, to have those conversations with your children or your people who will be caring for you, just so that everybody's on the same page about what you might want. Because, you know, one of the things is that if you are to have an event, in the context of having no advanced care directives, everything will be done. If you land up in the ER, everything will be done.
To keep you alive.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, at various times in your life, that might be absolutely what you want. But for many people who are really, you know, really towards the end of their life, you know, maybe they're in their 80s, whatever, you know, they've got kind of a chronic health condition. They're back and forth, you know, they're at the point where they're back and forth to the hospital all the time. And they're just not really kind of getting any better. And you go home every time and it's a little bit worse and your life is a little bit diminished and you haven't really made a plan about what you really want. You know, it's just good to have those conversations and think about, okay, what is really, you know, what is important to me? How do I want to spend my last days? So taking a look at the conversation. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to continue. You're about the conversation with your family and caregivers. Yeah,
absolutely. And you know, to me, any piece of that process is just really, it's a good reminder for us to notice, you know, what we love, what's important. You know, it's just a grim program. It's like, it actually, for many people, it's really a lovely exercise of appreciation of what we have and what's important. And
it could almost be another way of really clarifying how you want to live your life.
Exactly, exactly. And one of the things we do is we do workshops for people. So, you know, people get together in a group. There was a singles group that got together because, you know, it seemed a little bit like, okay, well, what do? You know, we're not in traditional situation of, you know, the spouse where you hopefully have told what you want. You know, it's like, okay, let's do this. And we had a lovely discussion because we did, you know, that's what these questions call you to do, is to reflect on what's important. And in fact, that's what working with anybody who is at end of life or grief, that those are the questions that come up from us. What's important? What do we love? And I think because it is those kind of questions, is that, you know, I've noticed, having been in this sort of field for quite a long time, people are really beginning to ask those questions more. And we are having more sort of cultural conversations about what matters, what do we want? And, you know, I just find that really, really encouraging.
Could you share, I know we don't have the document right in front of us, but what would be a question that's on that document that, can you recall? I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
Yeah, you are putting me on the spot.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Oh, my goodness. Sorry about
That's okay. But they are questions about, would you like artificial hydration? And do you want resuscitation? And do you want to be on a vent? Those are the sort of bottom line questions which you get to. But, you know, those are the things which they would want to know in the hospital. But, you know, the preamble of those questions will get you clearer about what's important. And when those decisions are made in the hospital, you generally would have somebody help you make those decisions, or help the loved one, your family or whoever it is, your loved ones make those decisions. But for them to understand what you care about first, yes, is really important.
That's really, as I said, the sense of clarity for your life. Mm-hmm. I think that's important when you're in your 20s or your 30s. Mm-hmm. This could really be clarity. I am going to climb that mountain, and I'm going to make sure that, yeah, X, Y, and Z is taken care of before I do X, sure, Y, and Z, you know, sure, that kind of thing. Mm. What is a training? What happens in a volunteer training?
Yeah, okay. The volunteer training is a time where we get together. It's an 8-week training in 8 weeks. I mean, once a week for a couple of hours. But it spreads over 8 weeks. And that's important because, you know, it is a little bit of a process in terms of, you know, getting to know each other. And we get to know each other and to learn a little bit more about hospice care and what it is, and taking care of people, what people who are in that dying phase might be going through physically and emotionally. But the most important piece of it, and, you know, as I say to volunteers, the most important piece is that people are just bringing to the training their hearts and their ears. So the most important piece of the training is actually about listening and learning to listen. And beyond that, you know, we explore some of the spiritual issues that might come up at the end of life. And, you know, the sort of medical issues and some of the family issues which tend to come up. And we do have one day, which is actually the most important days, is that, and it's an all-day training, which comes very soon after we start, the first Saturday after we start. And that's a day where we spend a day together, and it's a day for us just to explore our own grief and loss and how that's touched our lives. Because we know, and we've come to know, and we are very clear that to be able to do this work, we need to have, you know, examined, you know, had a look at our own grief and loss, and to be able to really be present with people who are dying, and to listen to people when they tell us their grief stories, we need to have been able to have touched our own and to have, you know, resolved some of those. And I think it's true to say pretty much that nearly all our volunteers have been through some big loss, and it has changed them, and it's changed their ability to be able to listen and really hold space. I mean, I think probably you may have experienced this if you're sharing with a loss about somebody, people are all too quickly to offer you the tissue and dab your tears dry and just kind of push away. They don't really want to necessarily hear how this is for you and to really kind of touch that tender space. So that's that day is one of the most important pieces of our training.
I would think so. Yeah. And to really get that sense of where you are in your own in your own mm-hmm. journey. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there is so much discomfort of, it'll get better, or the fixing.
Yeah.
You'll get
over it. That's one we hear all the time. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's been a week. Aren't you over this yet? I actually heard that after my mother died. I was 23. Yeah. I did laugh.
That's all right.
I said, "Oh, yeah, I'm going to need 8 days. I'm not going the 7 days just wasn't enough. The eight days was really what I need." But I'm goodness. So I could really see that, and of course you have to establish the sense of trust. Yeah. With the group mm-hmm. to be that mm-hmm. vulnerable.
Yeah, yeah. And we're bringing together people from all walks of life in Waller County, which is really awesome. People who may never have met each other in other spheres of their lives. And honestly, I'm just so excited every time we start another group, because they are some of the most wonderful, wonderful people. And many of the groups, they do get quite connected and go on, to have these deep and are able to, because they've done the training together, support each other as they go forward doing this work. And, it's hard. It's sad sometimes. It's tender. So it's really, we have a lovely community of volunteers, community of caring.
Mm-hmm. If you have just joined us, I'm Rhonda Feynman. This is the Healthy Options Program here on WERU Community Radio. We're speaking with Flick Shooter, who is the Executive Director of Hospice Volunteers of Waldo County, an organization that works closely with volunteers, families, and healthcare partners to ensure that no one in Waldo County faces serious illness, end-of-life decisions, or bereavement alone. That is so huge. And you do this, I know people have insurance, but it really, you're not charging. It's not like...
No, everything we do is always free of charge. Yeah, and we are, we're dependent on our generous community to keep the pieces. We're a very lean nonprofit. We don't have some fancy office. I'm talking to you from my city. From my dining room, but we do have. Well, I'm the one paid staff member, and we do have training materials and bereavement materials. We send out a bereavement mailing every month to anybody who, for a year after somebody lost somebody, so we do have costs, but our community supports our work, and we're really, really grateful for that. Maybe I can put in a plug for one of our really fun fundraisers.
Sure.
And it's an opportunity. It will be an opportunity for people to come down and meet us and connect with us. It's in April. The last Saturday in April.
In 2026. Yes.
Yes. This year. And we are going to have, we have a tea for the community. And it's an old fashioned English cream tea, which is lovely. Free scones and tea for everybody. And lovely seedlings from Villageside Farm, who Polly Shaker, who is one of the farmers there, they donate to us. She is also on our board of directors. And it's going to be one of the lovely organic seedlings there. But most of all, you can come down and meet with the volunteers and have a cup of tea and have a chat and learn more. We'd love to sign people up for maybe an advanced care director workshop or to talk to them about what we do. So that will be a good opportunity.
Yeah. And the website is really excellent. What is the website if people want to look?
It's hospicevolunteersofwaldocounty.org.
When you were, this is really important, and that sounds great. Are there going to be crumpets or is it scones? Okay.
It is all homemade scones, and you don't get more delicious than that.
Oh my gosh. Clotted cream? Okay, okay.
I did that.
Okay. Oh, okay. Well, there you go. Whew. So while we enjoy that, I do think your website is really well organized, and I was very interested in this sense, as we touched upon a few minutes ago, this sense of a process of grieving. And,
absolutely,
you know,
yeah.
I did make the joke, it's been a week, you know, but we know that, it's, and you talk about a year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in some traditions, spiritual traditions, the sense of grieving is exactly, there's the one month, there's the 3 months, there's the 6 months, there's the year. And you touch upon that on your website, and I'm hoping you could speak more about what you see as that process of
And you know, even though so under the hospice benefit, people are entitled to this 1 month of this 1 year of actually 13 months of bereavement support, which is designated to us to provide. But honestly, it can be so much more than that. And, you know, people say, oh, a year, aren't you over it? But, you know, a lot of people really are struggling after that year, partly because, you know, after that first year, if you've been caregiving, you spend that entire first year kind of coming out of this sort of shell shock change of routine with your eye in the rearview mirror thinking, okay, this time, this month I was doing that. This time, that month, we were here, you know. So lots of people really go through that first year kind of feeling somewhat numb, overwhelmed, and lonely, and may not actually start the kind of grieving process until well after that first year. But, you know, that doesn't matter for us. That we recognize that. So our mandate is any grief from any loss at any time. And one of the other things, every grief that we have reminds us of every other grief. So people will be surprised that they're grieving. They all of a sudden, they're just like these overwhelming grief bursts for somebody they kind of hardly knew. But maybe, you know, it's just tapping into some of the other pieces of grief that are sitting in your heart that are just too tender to look at. So I guess, you know, going back to after the loss, going back to your question, it can be that first week can be anything from just complete shock, exhaustion, shutdown, numbness, whatever. Sometimes it's relief. If you've been caregiving for a long time and watched your loved one diminished, it can feel like it just feels like all those emotions happen all at once. And sometimes I think that numbness that we feel is kind of our own little kind of psyche protecting us from basically our emotions blowing up. People kind of are concerned about that. You know, I kind of feel like, you know, actually that's okay. This is keeping you safe, because we can only unpack these things as we're able to and our situation allows. And there are some habits that we can get into to support our grief and to make it completely not unmanageable, if that might be a way of saying now, so that we're not completely, you know, and then there might be other times where we just want to be under the bedclothes with a covers over our head. And there might be times when, you know, just that smell of something will just start you bawling. Or, you know, that tune on the radio is like, whoa, where did that come from? You know, as you know, those memories come up. And so, yeah, it really is a process. But, you know, with loving awareness and support, we do get through it. We do, you know, it is part of the human experience. It's not some pathological whatever. It's kind of, we're playing the love tax. This is what we're doing. And
that's really, when you open your heart, you're opening it to everything.
Yeah. So with support and time and attention, and if we treat our grief kind of as a wound to tend to, as we would tend to any other wound, we get through, and grief changes us. Yeah, I mean, it changes us.
Well, certainly there can be a clarity as well about what you might want, having just experienced something. You could see, do I want this? Do I want that? Or how do I move forward? But that's not what you feel. I mean, that's not the time for that, is the first week or the first month necessarily.
No. Yeah. So, you know, as you work through through the process, and you know, it does get less tender. And on our website, we have there some monthly offerings of things sort of gradually begin to come up. You know, there's always kind of questions like, you know, the woulda, coulda, I could have done this, I should have done that, whatever. That's an inevitable part of it. Often that, you know, the guilt about, if only, those kind of come up. And then the loneliness, you know, that can all be part of it.
And even if you're surrounded by your grandkids, even if you're surrounded mm-hmm. by people who mm-hmm. love you or your mm-hmm. best friends,
yeah.
you can, mm-hmm. there can still be that sense of.
Yeah. And particularly for people, you know, many of the people who we have supported through the years are in their 80s. They may have been married partners with their spouse for 60 years, you know, maybe in their high school sweetheart. And really, it's kind of when they lose that person, it's like, you know, what have they lost? I mean, they've lost so much. They've lost their everyday companion. They, you know, sometimes it's a little bit unclear where the physicalness of it all is very surprising to some people. You know, that tender pain, that, you know, the upset stomachs, the, you know, the not being able to sleep, the...
Well, our mind-body connection is, yeah, as we
absolutely.
Talk about.
It's so, so strong. And where do you start and your partner end? I mean, it's just, it can be, you know, when you have been together that long and your lives are so much melded together. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lot. And trying to reinvent, you know, I think about the tasks of grieving as we ask ourselves, who have I lost? And who am I now? And how do I make a compelling vision of a future life for myself? You know, those are the big tasks within the grief circle that we attempt to navigate.
So you're talking about a grief group that people come together who have lost someone.
We do have grief groups. Yes, we do. We're just finishing a couple up right now. We have grief groups that run, some of them are online. Through the holidays, we put one online because the weather can be terrible. Often they're in person. When enough people come together, we can pull one together. We put people who have similar losses together. We actually have grief programs in the schools too. In our Belfast area schools, we have group in the high school, and we have a couple of groups in at Troy Howe Middle School and at the Beacope School. So yeah, we have groups, and people find them really, you know, sometimes I have to encourage people to go into them a bit, because grief is something that can feel so very, very private and very intimate. And for many people, they're kind of thinking, you know, how on earth could anybody else be feeling this intense? Some people are like, yeah, I want a group. Other people have to be a little bit encouraged into it. But then people find like, oh, right. So you are feeling like that, you know, that is, so there is amazing community, you know, there's nothing like being in a group and have people understand you like somebody else is going through it.
Well, so. This sense of vulnerability at mm-hmm. that point, especially if you've been the caretaker or you're the one who is always in quote, the illusion of in control, whatever that means. So all of a sudden you're not, or I have to be strong. I can't show this vulnerability. Or there's also, wouldn't you say that there's some, if someone is feeling relief after mm-hmm. that, there could be guilt about feeling.
Oh, yeah.
So how do you know.
And all, you know what, all these things probably going to happen all at once. All these emotions are going to be there. I mean, it's just like big old tangly, gnarly mess. And to be able to be in a group and, you know, sit next to somebody who says, yeah, I feel really guilty that I'm so relieved and that I can have fun now and they can't. And it's like, well, you know, you just have to kind of tease it out and be there and, yeah.
Well, the sense, the guilt of even smiling. I'm laughing. Oh, no, I shouldn't be because I'm grieving. Yep. But humor, you know, is tricky. But all of that is necessary.
And there are, absolutely. And that even amongst, honestly, our caregiver group, oh, dear, we did laugh a lot in that. Because, there's some really embarrassing, intimate, ridiculous moments. that happen when you're caregiving for somebody and your dignity just went down the toilet with everything else. You know, it's just like, sometimes you just got to laugh about that with somebody who's been there. And, you know, that's what the caregiver groups are about.
Right.
And also that admission is like, oh my goodness, you would like to,
Really?
All those are real and other caregivers get it. Whereas, you know, your normal person on the street might be a little bit shocked and horrified if you were to to admit that.
But you want to say, just wait, because life is happening everywhere and this could be you.
Generally.
Yep. Right. And it could be. Chances are. Yeah. I want to get back to that sense of working with the kids. Because especially in our culture, a young person has an accident, your best friend or something happens, or your mother, your grandfather, your caregiver, your, you know, and that is often not addressed. Yeah. If the adults around you are not dealing with it, how do you deal with it? Or if they are, then of course that environment would be more encouraging. Yeah. So how do these groups go with a little differently, obviously, than
you mean in the schools?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. So yeah, they are just, we've been working in the schools for a long, long time. So we work with the counselors who, obviously, you're in a position to know people who've had a loss. And what's really awesome is that the kids, some of the kids come back year after year, and some of the kids who are in middle school are actually now in the grief in the high school groups, which is really special. We have a fantastic team who they kind of, so the things that we do, you know, the adult groups are kind of more sit around and talk kind of thing. But the kids are more, they mostly do activities. So the team has figured out some really interesting sort of activities that they do that allow the kids to kind of name what's going on with them and to speak and play things like a kind of bingo game where, you know, you have cards which maybe a feeling that they might. And then there is Lindsay McGuire, who coordinates our school team. She has come up with a really fabulous board game called The Worst Game in the World. And it's kind of an adapted snakes and ladders game, if you can imagine that. And the kids love to play that. And it just gives a space, a safe space to talk about the unthinkable. And, you know, when kids are together in a group, a lot of them may not actually realize that maybe there's other kids in the group that have lost somebody. And it just creates this a safe space for kids to talk about something where there isn't a space in the usual school day.
Right. Yeah. Or an expectation. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Yes, really.
Yeah.
It's like life is normal. And other kids, you know, it would be so interesting, and I don't know, to kids who haven't had losses to really understand and get educated on how to navigate that. And I imagine some can do that kind of naturally with empathy and compassion.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, interestingly, one of the students who was at Troy Howard, when they were in the high school, they then became one of the leaders of the group. So you know, just being able to get comfortable to be able to have peer conversations, and you know, I think many of our kids, I think they're way more emotionally literate than I was as a kid. You know, they can have these conversations and are doing so. So, you know, it's nice to be able to support the ones that happen around grief, because, you know what, there's an awful lot of grief in our community in many, many ways, you know, from the existential to the reality to the, so many aspects of grief.
Sure. If you have just joined us, you are listening to Healthy Options on WERU Community Radio. I'm Rhonda Feynman, and our guest today is Flick Shooter, Executive Director of Hospice Volunteers of Waldo County. We're discussing the services offered by hospice volunteers and end-of-life issues, serious illness, and grief and caregiving for all of these needs. And now we're learning about how that's being impacted with young people as well, of course, because this is a part of life. Yeah. These things mm-hmm. happen. I'd like to talk about more about the stages. You know, what many of us have read over the years, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who is mm-hmm, an educator mm-hmm. and had the five stages. Or is that the sort of thing you're doing when I see on the website you have the months, or, you know, this is the first month, this is the third, second, you have a lovely mm-hmm. breakdown of that, or is it through that kind of lens, or just, and because everybody's grief is so individual. Yeah, and yet they're universal nervous system things that happen as being part of the human race.
Yeah. So yes and no about the stages. You know, I think, you know, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, when she did that really wonderful pioneering work, I think there was a lot of confusion in that she wasn't tossing out, this is the blueprint. she was tossing out more, this is a framework in which we can explore this human experience. And I think that's, you know, that's what's important. We are talking about a human experience, and everybody does their own grief a different way. And every loss impacts us in different ways. And I think, you know, I as I mentioned before, I find it more helpful to think about it in these questions of, you know, who have I lost? Who were they to me? And then we get to unpack this incredibly, you know, this relationship that we had, and who they, you know, they were our support person. They were our person we snuggled up at night with. They were, you know, the person who listened to us unconditionally,
or not,
or not. Exactly. And you know, that's the other piece of it. There is a lot of or not about it. It's not all nice sort of butterflies and rainbows. You know, it's complex because we're complex and our relationships are complex. So that's sort of, you know, amid the, like, okay, what do I do now? Clear up the stuff that, you know, the paperwork and all that stuff you have to deal with after a death. This is like, that is part of the process. And then as we've, you know, as we've figured out a little bit about who these people are to us, it's like, well, who am I without that person? You know, I'm the person who goes to the movies on their own. You know, that's, you know, just in, and you can't, you stumble. I mean, grief is a, you know, happens all the time. The reality of it, you know, the experience of it is there all the time as you understand this missing and change. And I think, you know, we, particularly if we move into the habits of paying attention, which is really one of the biggest ones about, you know, where we are with ourselves, we can, you know, kind of move on through the process of feeling not quite so numb or gutted, or, you know, we're still going to have these grief bursts as we, you know, we get that song or that smell or that, you know, memory or whatever, way we feel like we're right back as where it was so tender and so vulnerable at the very beginning when we heard the news, or we, you know. But I think we do manage to make ourselves, well, one of the widowers described it to me in what I felt was a really kind of helpful way that I, an analogy I passed on. He said, you know, it felt like I was drowning. It felt like I was walking along underwater, like hardly able to breathe, when just at the beginning. And I was just like there, you know, under the ocean. And then I would be there for a while. And every now and again, I would come up and, you know, gasp for air, and I could like see around me for a moment, but then, I'd be pulled back down again into the kind of darkness and whatever. And then he said, you know, eventually I just felt I was just like coming up more often and staying up for longer, until a point where I could pretty much stay up there all the time. And to me, you know, that kind of felt an analogy that was felt kind of graphic and resonated with a lot of the experiences that had been shared with other people. So Yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
Oh, I think that's a really beautiful beautiful analogy and experience. It's like mm-hmm. it was real. This was not just a movie. And you know, the other thing about being the caretaker or dealing with these issues, it's almost like priorities really clarify, don't they?
Oh goodness, yeah, absolutely, yeah. And I think honestly, I think one of the hardest things for caregivers to do in the midst of being completely overwhelmed, not to mention, you know, probably, you know, you're grieving somebody you're losing. You may also be really pissed off at them for abandoning you. Are all those, and just completely physically exhausted from having been awake, you know, every time they call or whatever, and being really scared. Maybe you're really anxious about, you know, how you're going to keep going financially, as now you only have one social security check coming in rather than the pair of them, or, you know, or maybe you're going to lose your home, or because, you know, you're not going to be able to pay the property tax. I mean, all those things can be present there at caregiving. The idea is that you are going to take some nurturing time for yourself is kind of, honestly, can feel like a bit of a joke. And, you know, the idea that you're going to go to that doctor's appointment that you really need to go to because you have a health issue too can be really like, yeah, right. So, you know, but being able to take care of yourself as a caregiver is really, you know, is really key to be able to make it sustainable. And hopefully that's where we as volunteers can step in and maybe come sit with your person while you go for that doctor's appointment, or while you do that piece of self-care, or just take a walk outside, or, you know, just do something for yourself to remind you that you are a being yourself worthy of love and consideration and care. Because, you know, it's terribly easy to, you know, to think that you can give it all away, but, you know, you can't ultimately.
And with the volunteers, there's that training of listening, of being able to say, yeah, I get it. I mm-hmm. get it. And not and being practical. I get it. Not trying to fix. I mean, we'd love to fix, right? We always want to have some of us are, you know, we get into these professions. So this is what you should do. Well, I don't know what you should do. But I can tell you, I can hear, listen to mm-hmm. to what you're telling me and what your experience is, and there are just so many levels of that experience. Is that part of the training, to really, with the caregivers, you know, that sense of, you know, being able to hold whatever they're expressing?
Listening is the key part of the training, really. And you know, volunteers may hear some hard stuff. They may not, you know, they may not get to, maybe they won't. But there is always, you know, a community for them. You know, if they were to hear hard stuff, for example, the understanding is that they would let me know and we could talk about it and see what other support. And the other thing is that, you know, we are, or when the hospice team is in the home, we are the eyes and the ears of the team too, because one of the things that's happened certainly increasingly, and I've certainly seen this over the last couple of decades of watching how the hospice teams used to be able to spend so much time in the home with their patients. You know, they were able to hang out and really spend a huge amount of time, and same with the home health aides. Now there's just so much more pressure to get to the next patient. You know, the volunteers often serve as the ears and the eyes in the home for the team. So if they can hear, if they hear something concerning or something that they see that could, you know, really be useful, they can let me know, and then I'm the link with the medical providers, and I can maybe pass it on to the team and see if there's something that we can help them with.
That is really important. That is, again, coming back full circle to the idea that this is, you're working with other medical teams, you're working with people who are on this whole team of caregivers and such. And I think that's a really good point. We're going to be ending in a moment, but I do want to say that what we've talked about is thinking about what's important to you, whether you're in that situation or not. I just like to reiterate that. Mm-hmm. And we'll have resources that we'll put on the website when we mm-hmm. archive this mm-hmm. as mm-hmm. well. So this is just so important. All of this is a piece, isn't it? The practical, the emotional, the spiritual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you would like more information and would like to meet some of the volunteers, on Sunday, April 26, 2026, from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m., Hospice Volunteers of Waldo County is hosting a community tea party, which includes complimentary tea and scones. They will also be offering seedlings for sale as a fundraiser for this organization. That's Sunday, April 26th, from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m., down at the Boathouse in Belfast for the Hospice Volunteers of Waldo County Community Tea Party and Fundraiser. Our guest today on Healthy Options has been Flick Shooter, Executive Director of Hospice Volunteers of Waldo County. Thanks again for sharing with us all the work that hospice volunteers are doing right here in Waldo County. And we also appreciate that you could offer some valuable information and guidance to help people facing the issues outside of our region, too. Hopefully, there's something like this wherever you are in your listening area. The website for Hospice Volunteers of Waldo County is hospicevolunteersofwaldocounty.org. That's hospicevolunteersofwaldocounty.org. You can find the link to this show and other information that was mentioned when it's posted on the public affairs section at the Healthy Options Archives at weru.org. Get the WERU app. It takes only a minute, and you can listen to Healthy Options as a podcast. Thanks to Joel Mann at WERU for engineering support. Thanks to Petra Hall for co-producing. And as always, thanks to all of our WERU listeners and supporters. This is Rhonda Feynman wishing you the best in health.